For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Welcome. I'm very, very happy to have with us this morning as our guest teacher, Peter Coyote, Reverend Peter Coyote, Reverend Hosho Peter Coyote, who's a Zen priest in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, ordained just a little while ago, and preparing for Dharma transmission with my friend Lou Richman, who's a teacher in our lineage. And Peter's also well known as an activist. He was involved in starting the student protest movement in the early 60s. He was one of the founders of the Diggers, who provided food and medicine and housing for the hippies in the heyday of the Haight-Ashbury. He's been involved in all kinds of environmental and peace and social justice activism ever since. He also happens to have had a film career, so some of you may know him from A Man in Love, or Bitter Moon, or A Walk to Remember, or E.T., or Aaron Brockovich, and you'll recognize his voice from many documentaries. Anyway, Peter, it's so wonderful to have you here at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. You forgot about how they found me in the bulrushes.
Oh yeah, well, you know, I didn't want to go that far back.
I'm really, really happy to be here. It's wonderful to travel all across the country and come to a Zendo that's this friendly and this solid in its practice. And I've known Taigen for a long time, and it's the first time I've been here, but I'm not surprised that it has just a perfect feeling. And I've been really happy here. I've gotten to meet a lot of you running my crazy mass classes, but we had a lot of fun. And part of the reason has to do with the Sangha. You can't do it alone, no matter how great the teacher is. And so thank you all for making me welcome and comfortable. I want to talk today about way-seeking mind. That's kind of the center line of the highway, but my mind is as digressive as Taigen's, so you'll be comfortable following me through the twists and turns that I make. It's actually the mind that brings us to practice. We think very often that we've made some really deep, intelligent decision to come and practice, but that's really our small mind comforting us. Actually, the big mind that we're all always a part of, never separate of, that's actually what brings us to practice. That's what's always on our side. That's what's actually moving it all. And so one of the qualities or byproducts of this way-seeking mind, I'm sure you've heard this word, bodhicitta. Two Sanskrit words. Bodhi means awake, and citta comes from a root that means aware of. So it's the mind that's aware of being awake, and it's the mind that wishes enlightenment and the end of suffering for all sentient beings and pledges to seek enlightenment to make of oneself a vehicle to end the suffering of all sentient beings, and also accepts the fact of an intangible sort of vaporous self, not a fixed self. It's a big sentence for such a little word, but it covers a lot of territory. And of course, being Buddhism, you know that it's been made part of a list, you know, just like, everybody has the Eightfold Path and the Six Paramitas. And so there are three kind of understandings of bodhicitta that I like. So the first is called the Way of the King. And the Way of the King is basically the way where the king seeks his own benefit, primarily. That's what he's doing. But he knows that things are not going to work unless his kingdom's in order and unless his people are happy. So he looks after them. It's kind of enlightened selfishness. The next is the path of the boatman. And the boatman is the one that ferries us across the water. And the water in Buddhism, you know, is a kind of metaphor for a pre- and post-enlightened mind. And the ferryman has us in the front of the boat, but he's actually traveling with us. So it's more, he shares the pilgrimage with us. But then finally, there's the way of the shepherd. And the shepherd actually puts his sheep really in front of him. He cares for them, and he takes them where they have to go, and he's the last to cross. And this was the great contribution of Mahayana Buddhism to human thought. This was the Bodhisattva ideal. I'm sure you've all been in some organization, if not some Zen centers, where people are so eager to get enlightenment or to get the promotion or to get the gravy that they'll clamor all over you and crush you in their effort to save all beings. And the Mahayana people took care of that with the Bodhisattva ideal. It was go first. Go first. When we're driving and the guy cuts us off in traffic, we can say, go first, before we give him the finger. Which is very perilously close to pulling a trigger. So it's a great model. We don't have to be in a hurry. Our job is to look after other people, to take care of everyone, and see that they're okay. And then we'll be okay, because really, we're not separate. So the Bodhisattva ideal is kind of manifested by the six perfections. And I have to read the Sanskrit names because I can never remember them. Actually, at the last, because I'm an autodidact and I read a lot of this myself, at the last Zen center, the abbot there, Galen Godwin, actually gave me a little card with the correct pronunciation of the paramitas after only 40 years of practice. So don't worry, there's plenty of time to make mistakes. So what are they and why am I talking about them? So the first is dana, which is the practice of giving. I'm sure you all practice some sort of that in supporting this sangha, and either through labor or through money to help pay the rent and do that. It's another way of practicing generosity. It's another way of practicing selflessness. Sila is ethics, but it also stands for morality and discipline and proper conduct. You can't have a sangha, you can't have a community unless we behave correctly toward one another. Kshanti stands for patience. Patience has a lot of manifestations. Forbearance is one of them. Tolerance is one of them. Acceptance. If you've ever sat a session, endurance. Virya. Virya is vigor and energy. It's the way we go about our practice. Wholeheartedly. We hold nothing back. It's diligence. It's vigor. It's effort. When we make a bow, doesn't matter if we like the person or not, we make this wholehearted bow and we're in perfect balance. When we give our attention to someone, we give the totality of our attention to that person and we're practicing one of the paramitas. Dhyana, jhana, you probably already know, is meditation, one-pointed concentration, contemplation. And then finally, prajna, which you probably chant every day when you do the Heart Sutra, which is wisdom, insight. All of these imply an action. All of these imply a commitment to doing something, even if it's doing nothing. And finally, none of them imply that any of it is done for the self. This is the goal of our practice, is to live the life of a Buddha. And these are the qualities of a Buddha, these six paramitas. And so when we're doing them, that's where we're aiming to arrive at. We're not sitting to get enlightened. We're not sitting to change ourselves. We're sitting, we're letting the small self soften and weaken. We're practicing these paramitas and the Eightfold Path because our prize is to live the life of a Buddha. Pema Chodron, perhaps because she's a woman and a great teacher, she talks about bodhicitta as being the completely open heart of the wound, of the world, as tender as a wound. And she relates it to us in an instinctive way that we can understand. She says it is love. It's the manifestation of love. And Chogyam Trungpa reminds us that everybody loves something, even if it's only tortillas. So this love can be manifested and can be perceived in completely inanimate things and gestures. And there's a little story about it. In the Meiji era of Japan, which was kind of the beginning of the modern era, around 1870 to 1912, there was a little boy named Morita whose mother had died. His father was an advanced practitioner, and he couldn't care for the boy, so he sent him to Eiji. And before he sent him, he gave him a very strict talking to. He said, you know, you'll have the most meaningless chores, the smallest chores in the temple. Meaningless is the wrong word. But they give you tough chores. You'll be sweeping. Well, when you sweep, that's only half the job. If you don't take the sweepings and take them over to the fire pit, you've only done half the work. Haven't been wholehearted. If you do that, you'll have done half the work, even if there's 10 people working with you. And another thing they'll ask you to do is they'll ask you to ring the gong. And he said, I want to tell you that when you ring the gong, every time you ring the gong, you're giving birth to a Buddha. And senior students will always bow to the gong before they hit it. So, one morning, Morita Zenji hit the great bell, and Ekido Zenji, who was the master of Eiji at that time, a very senior advanced man, 90-something years old at this time, he heard the gong, and he said to his assistant, who was that? Bring that person to me. And so he was expecting an advanced student or a senior monk, and he was very surprised to see a 12-year-old boy come in the room. And he asked him about that, and he said, how did you get such a wonderful sound? And the boy said, well, to hit a bell is to give birth to a Buddha. And Ekido Zenji was so impressed by this that he took this boy under his wing until he grew up to receive transmission as Morita Zenji, a great, great Zen master. So even through a wall, even the act of hitting a chime transmitted the fundamental intention of the person holding the staff. And so the slightest thing we do, the way we sweep, the way we clean the altar, the way we trim the candle, the way we bow to one another, is an expression of that fundamental affection toward a world that we are inseparably a part of. This is ordinary life. Ordinary life to a Buddhist. We call it ordinary life, but it's actually not so ordinary, is it? It's actually a very perilous life. It's filled with dangers. It's difficult to find trustworthy people. It's difficult to find things we can trust and people we can believe. And so in such a time as this, it becomes critically important to make ourselves trustworthy, to make ourselves dependable, to make ourselves believable. Because as things fall apart, as the threads that hold society together stress, as the environment stresses and falls apart, it's going to become really critical to know people and be people who can keep their heads when things are falling apart, who don't succumb to fear, who will do what they say they're going to do, who will be dependable, who will be trustworthy. And this is part of the gift. This is part of the giving, the dana, that we give to the world as monks, as laymen, as followers of the Buddha. It's not necessary to be a great person. It's necessary to be a helpful person. And our practice prepares us for this. Human nature is always the same. It's never going to be perfect. It's half dark and half light. And our job is to understand the totality of our nature. If we try to take the dark away, we no longer have a circle. That's an idea. That's not big mind. That's your idea of yourself. If you come to your cushion and you have some idea that you're seeking enlightenment, your idea of your mind is over here, and your idea of enlightenment is over here, and those two symbols will never clash. We sit just to sit. We trust this practice. We trust this Sangha. We do it because Buddha told us to do it. That's really hard for Westerners. What do you mean? I got to have a reason, man. And really, that's it. Because we're giving up. That little self that's complaining and curious and resistant, that's the captain in the wheelhouse that's making all the trouble. We want to send him outside, put the boat on autopilot. You know, let Buddha take over the wheel. And if we do that, we will have an enlightenment experience. And if we don't do that, and we have some kind of enlightenment experience, it will never be solid. It will always be shaky. So we're never going to create a spiritual life that's perfect, like we imagine it. And we don't work on our spiritual life the same way we work on our everyday life. When we sit, we're actually sitting between two worlds or two modes of perception. There's the everyday world of the five senses, in which every grain of sand and every snowflake and every human being, including our little self, is separate and unique. And then there's the absolute, the great mind, in which everything is totally interdependent, empty of a fixed self, made of non-self elements. We sit upright between the two. We don't favor them. We don't lean into our problems. We don't lean away from our problems. We don't try to stay in the absolute. We don't try to stay in the independent. We sit upright. And by sitting upright, little by little, we soften the barrier between them. We make the invisible barrier permeable. And we drift back and forth, back and forth. And when we get up from our cushion, we're not trying to stay in Zazen mode. That's a perfect way to get hit by a bus. When we get up from our cushion, we're human beings, and we're like everyone else, except that we have an echo or a residue or some feeling of big mind with us. And when we act, we understand that that act is affecting the entire universe. So we act with that consciousness, and we act within the framework of the Eightfold Path, and we act within the framework of the Paramitas. The only way that we can do this is to fully accept the full dimension of our human nature. If we don't understand that we are and can be His Holiness the Dalai Lama, or Hitler, or Pol Pot, or Thich Nhat Hanh, or a hospice nurse, it's all there, because human nature is no nature. It has no fixed form. Somewhere on earth, people are eating people, and somewhere on earth, people are saving people. They're all human beings, just like us. And if we can't accept the fullness of our humanity, we can't really control it, because you won't see it. If you have an idea that you're just a good person, you're not seeing your shadow. And I promise you, it will leak. It will leak when you're jealous. It will leak when you're angry. It will leak when you're tense. It will leak when you're upset. Tenshin Reb Anderson said a wonderful thing to me 30 years ago. We were talking, and he said, you know, most people consider themselves good people. Most Americans, we're the good guys. We wear the white hats. And we go through the world that way, causing a great deal of trouble, a great deal of suffering for other people. Tenshin said, it's much safer for me to think that I'm a very dangerous person. And then I'm very, very careful. And I find that I cause much, much less damage. And that really impressed me, and it's something I've practiced, because in my years in the counterculture, where I just assumed I was a great person, and I just assumed I was an enlightened person, I just left disaster after disaster behind me. And a number of people died following my example. Between 1965 and 1975, I buried 18 friends in my immediate community. Some of them were young people who had looked up to me, and I wasn't conscious that they were doing that, and they imitated my behavior, and they never made 21. So there are real consequences, and the universe, karma, is not forgiving. So if we're careless, hopefully by the time we reach this age, we've learned to be careful, and we've learned to be tender. So the more we reflect on this fullness of our nature, it's quite possible that we can get depressed. We can start to look at our shadows and go, oh my God, that guy was wrong. I'm 99% worthless and hopeless. But that's not true either. You know, that's just human nature to take it all the way out. It's about 50-50. And you're never going to get rid of it. As long as we have this human body, we have the karma of a human body. Your problems are never going to fully disappear. But what's going to happen is, once you get outside the realm of small mind and small self, and you loose these problems into big mind, well, you know, it's like having an unruly dog in a small apartment, or taking him out to a football field to run around. If he's running around on a football field, he just passes you every once in a while. And when he passes you, you can either call him in or groom him or do something. It's the same with our problems. They don't torment us in the same way. But if we think that enlightenment is a fence and we're going to climb over it and be on autopilot in some kind of blissful, sexless nirvana where everything works perfectly, these are mental pets, and we need to let them loose. We need to take them away, because they will disappoint you. Because then you'll be sitting there and you'll think, this didn't work. I better find another path. I better find a doctor with a better medicine. And it's really your own small mind and attachment to it, our own. I have the same small mind you do. I said that. I said that. I describe my mind sometimes as five gerbils loose in a weasel cage. And I just have this image of these terrified little creatures running around and grabbing the chicken wire, and each one is a thought taking me in another direction. So it's very funny. It's very, it's a fact that this way-seeking mind has to be realized in the actual flesh and blood world of living and dying and suffering, as Buddha did. We're never going to remake the world. You can't pour a quart into a pint pitcher. We're never going to have a world without greed, without hatred, without delusion, without people hurting each other. And if you're waiting for that, before you allow yourself to be happy. If you can't be happy in this world as it is, the prognosis is not fun. Somehow, you have to find a way to accept the miracle of this life and the joy of it and the fleeting transiency of it and everything that comes along with us. And one of the gifts that Buddha gave us as human beings was to demonstrate, to model how to be joyful, how to be content in the world as it actually is. And for guys like Tigan and myself who are activists, there's some part of us that's always like beating against the door and saying, that shouldn't be. And that's true. You know, free market capitalism should not be evicting 6,000 people a month and putting their stuff on the front lawn while the bankers that ruined the economy did not pay a penny in fine. Shouldn't be. But if I can't be happy while I'm saying that, if I can't be happy in that world, who's going to want to be a Buddhist like me? So one of the reasons that I like this Sangha so much is people are really friendly. In a lot of sanghas and a lot of cities, actually, the Tibetans are kind of taking over because they're so happy. They have a lot of fun. And they come in and people go up, then they come up to a little Zen center and say, someone answers the door and goes, may I help you? I am so out of there, like right away. But I come here and people are friendly and people are happy and I think, yeah, this is the kind of Buddhism I want to practice. This is what I want to follow. Now, at the same time that we're practicing, this is a little contradictory thing, at the same time that we're practicing Zazen and we're talking about selflessness, our actual practice, in another way, is just for ourselves. Hmm. No one has the same experience that you do. Very often we have this idea, Suzuki Roshi used to call this idea the scientific view of the self, meaning we try to see ourselves from outside with some kind of objective standard, like a scientific principle, empirically verifiable experiments. I create an experiment and you can replicate it and you'll get the same result. But we can't see ourselves that way. That's not the way we experience ourselves. We experience ourselves from inside. We are not objective. We are a unique and curious expression of the universe. And even though that self doesn't exist the way we think it does, there's no little polished kernel with your name on it tucked under your gallbladder, which is a separate part of the universe. We exist, we all have the feeling we exist, but we don't exist in the way we think we exist. Because 5 minutes of examination will show us that we've never been independent of sunshine and water and microbes and germs and pollinating insects and digestive enzymes and all these things. So our self is made of all those things. That's why Buddha called it empty. But still, our experience in this body with these five senses is ours. And if I try to impose my experience on you, that's an act of violence. That's actually an act of trying to colonize your experience. And so that's another contradiction that we have. We sit together. I can only hope that most of you are not experiencing what I am when I'm sitting. But somehow, when we get up as human beings, we get up as these cooperative people, and we're able to work together because we've given ample space for our individual, curious, little bubbling boil of self to exist. And that's quite important. Dogen Zenji referred to this as establishing the self on the self. He didn't mean there were two selves, like a bad self and a good self. He meant establishing this small self and opening it up so that you can settle it on the big self, on big mind. That's the one that we can trust. That's the one that we can just be intuitive about. In my mass classes, many of you had an experience yesterday of putting a mask on, finding a person in it when I held up a mirror, and being instructed by that person how to behave. Finding narratives and stories that you had no idea that existed a second before. That's trusting big mind. It wasn't you. It wasn't your ego making it up. Sorry, I get terrible cramps in my calves. Okay, said that. So big mind is always on our side. What do I mean by that? I mean that it's actually trying to help us. That when we sync ourselves with the universe, everything is going to flow right, even if we don't understand it. Things sort of work out. And even if they don't work out the way we wanted them to, they're still working out all right. As you come to accept this, it's pretty important not to be frightened by the calmness that occurs. A lot of people sit zazen and they start to calm down and they get really frightened. They start to think, oh my God, my fire is going out. Maybe this is dying. No, it's not. This is our birthright. It's our birthright to be relaxed. It's our birthright to be calm. It's our birthright to have our time as long as the universe allows us to have form. And all the anxieties and all the problems and everything that exists in this body of karma, we are practicing with to learn how to take our ease, to learn how to take our time, to learn how to teach our bodies to practice these paramitas. These paramitas are not ideas. If the body can't practice compassion, it's meaningless. If the body can't practice patience, it's meaningless. You've pulled the trigger, you've given a guy the finger. It's too late. So returning to this practice, returning day after day, just because your teacher told you to, or just because Buddha told us to, and having some faith that there have been 95 generations of people that have done that and kept this practice alive to this day for us, exemplified it for us. And even if the histories in many cases are false, even if the Chinese made up the names of Indian ancestors so their temples could compete for patronage with one another, it doesn't matter, because somebody was there, or we wouldn't be there. So really, that's all I wanted to say. I wanted to congratulate you on this practice. I'm so comfortable here. I watched you all sit. You're all so solid. You're all friendly. You're in this lovely place. And you are creating a bulwark against contemporary, empty, modern life. And just down the street is another temple, a Korean temple. And all over the country, there are these little spores. The last thing I'll say is an example. In 1975, there was a guy named Prigogine who won the Nobel Prize. And he won the Nobel Prize for proving that under great stress, organisms sometimes make a transcendent leap. That when a body or an institution is stressed to a certain degree, they sometimes evolve to a higher level that includes both sides of the contradiction, stressing it. Well, I think of these sanghas growing up in America. I think of the thousands and thousands of people and sanghas, Tibetan sanghas, Indian sanghas, Japanese sanghas, Korean sanghas. I imagine them on the body of the United States, and I thought, if that was my body, and each of those sanghas was a little spot of cancer, I would not say it was minimal. And so we're out here all cooperating in this thousand-year game, trying to change this culture, really, not through evanescent ideas, but through the training and taming of greed, hate, and delusion, the building of a sangha, the trusting of ourselves and our practitioners and our teacher, to claim the reward of living like Buddhas. Thank you very much. Happy to take any questions from those that are awake.
So everyone, please feel free to give comments, responses, questions to Peter.
So an actor giving a Dharma talk is a little bit like Samuel Johnson's talking dog. It's not that it does it well, it's that it does it at all. Well, that's done.
No? Okay, I'll ask a question. Huh?
Sure.
Oh, wait, Douglas has one. Go ahead.
Excuse me.
Thank you for your talk, Peter. Wearing robes is an unusual thing in today's world. How do you relate your decision to ordain to bodhicitta?
Well, I was never going to be a priest. I was never going to be a teacher unless somebody asked me, because I couldn't imagine a way of saying to my teacher, I want to teach, without it being an expression of ego. So I just kept practicing. And finally one day my teacher said, it's time for you to start talking and teaching. And I said what any of you would say, oh, come on, no, I'm not nearly ready for that. At least the ones that don't say that are the ones you have to be scared of. But I did say that. No, I don't think I'm ready for that. He said, look, there are always people behind you you can help, and there are always people in front of you that you can learn from. I said, oh, okay. So then he asked me to take this 3-year priest training course, which I did. And I was really impressed by the quality of the people there. And I was thinking that maybe I would get a green raksu or a lay entrustment. I was not interested so much in being a priest. But I realized that, A, if I got a green raksu, I would always be under the tutelage of a teacher. I would never be independent. And if I found somebody, I could never transmit a lineage. At least that's what I thought. And that's a struggle that's going on in American Buddhism about what the meaning of the green raksu is, and whether teachers can, or green raksu teachers can ordain people or transmit. Anyway, and then I thought, well, my heritage and my lineage is from the San Francisco Zen Center. And there's a definite prejudice in the San Francisco Zen Center toward priests. And I thought, well, I don't want to start out second to anybody. And maybe I'll just try to step up my game and do that. So I did that, and I lo and behold, I found that it changed me. And the ways in which it changed me, and the ways in which it became an expression of bodhicitta, unlike, let's say, someone like Jack Kornfeld and Vipassana practice at Spirit Rock, who does no ceremonies whatsoever. It's like a completely secular practice. Well, maybe it's my background as an actor, but my experience has been that people dig ceremony, and they need it. And the first time I did a funeral and was kind of holding the ceremonial space for people that were shrieking and throwing themselves on the coffin and just holding that for them, letting them know it was safe to do that, and then walking them through personal loss and then transpersonal and then into big mind, and then we all chanted the Heart Sutra as we pushed the button on the crematorium, chanting and drumming and chanting. When we walked back to the funeral home, everybody was laughing and telling jokes about the departed. And I was flabbergasted. I thought, that's what ceremony does. That's how you help people across some barrier. And I love doing weddings, because you're creating the world anew. You're bringing two people together to make a new hybrid that didn't exist before. And every wedding, every marriage is an opportunity to reinvent the world and start it anew. And I love offering it within the framework of compassionate practice. And so this is my Zen tuxedo, you know, my little white stuff, and I feel a little bit like Cary Grant sometimes. But when you come in, you're holding the ceremonial space, and you're fulfilling a role. It's not that I'm such a great guy, it's that there's a role to be held, and someone has to be the officiant. And I've been trained by my practice to do that, and it's helpful to people. And so that's why I do it. And when I'm counseling someone, very often I never mention even Zen Buddhism. I have a penchant for working with mechanics and cowboys and really lay people that I grew up with on ranches and stuff, mechanics. If I can help them or say something that will be of some use, I don't have to mention Zen Buddhism, because a lot of people have exaggerated mental ideas. Say Zen Buddhist to a Baptist, they're gone. Meditation to a Baptist, it's over. So I'm looking for ways ultimately to make Zen vernacular to America. I honor my teachers with this tradition, but you know, 1,000 years from now, we'll be doing it slightly differently. We're already starting to see mindfulness as kind of an American adjustment. It ain't Buddhism, folks. It doesn't have an ethical component to it. Buddhism is not just mindfulness. Buddhism is the Eightfold Path and the Six Paramitas. You don't take a course and pay someone to teach you mindfulness to be a better corporation of a bomb-making factory. But it's a start. And it may be that the compassion of the West is actually linked with psychology and human rights, and that that may infect Buddhism in a beneficent way, in the same way that Bon infected it in Tibet and Shinto in Japan and Confucianism in China. So I just see this as an expression of bodhicitta, and it fits my talents. I could apply whatever charisma I have to selling tampons and razor blades on television with movies, but it wasn't very satisfying. And now I can give it towards something that I feel is consistent with my deepest values. So I'm putting one foot in front of the other and trying to do that.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
We have some time if there are other comments or questions or responses.
Are you asking a question?
Carla, hi Carla.
So this question might really be unanswerable, but I would appreciate your thoughts on it. What is the secret to being happy in the midst of, you know, the world as it is, the suffering, the injustice? Maybe you're using a different definition of happiness than I would, or somehow my definition is just maybe full of delusion or something, because I can't reconcile happiness and, you know, living in this world of suffering and injustice. So what are your thoughts on that?
How many people practice when they sit, sitting with a half smile? It's a really wonderful practice. It's not a big smile. It's just this. You're modeling happiness. And if you have that smile, you'll feel happy. You're not condoning anything. You're not saying suffering doesn't exist. You're sitting in the middle of it. But you're lucky to be sitting. You're lucky to be in a sangha. You're lucky to be with dependable and trustworthy people, and why wouldn't that make you happy? And so to shift your attention from that, to think about, you know, orphans in Latin America getting their kidneys ripped out to be sold, is not going to help your practice. If you want to do something about that in your waking existence, you can. And then you should be happy that you're able to help people. But part of the problem is language. And one of the things about deep experience is that language falls away. Language is a great gift, and it really helps us. but it also imposes very, very strict limits. If I say tree, well, it's useful to see a tree, but you're not really seeing a tree. You're not really seeing all the interfaces and functions that it does, holding soil, blanketing the roots with leaves so they don't freeze, a home for insects and birds, gathering water and keeping it underground. So it's easy to cut down a tree. It's a little more difficult to attack the web of life. So language imprisons us in the logic and syntax of grammar. You can't have two contradictory things existing in the same space in language. But when language falls away, and you actually have some perception of the world just as it is, what Suzuki Roshi called things as it is, everything's in its right place. Everything exists because of consequences that followed from something that happened just before it. And those consequences exist from previous consequences. And each of those things have a kind of karma. And it's a kind of arrogance. Again, it's like taking away the dark half of yourself. You don't commit suicide because you have difficulties and problems and meanness and anger and find yourself wanting in some place. And so why should we give up our joy because the world contains things that are horrifying and cruel? I don't have a secret. I have an ongoing struggle not to get thrown off my balance and not to let myself get... You know, I have a long history as a little commie Jew building soapboxes and making megaphones and shouting at people and telling them what to do and what to think. Never did a thing. Just satisfied me to be angry and separate myself from the bad guys. But I am the bad guy. I am greedy. I am oppressive. I am everything any human being is. Hopefully, after 40 years of practice, a little more under control. But none of that means that I don't have the right to be happy to have a human existence. And then, if you were suffering, would you want somebody to come help you who was suffering and in interminable pain, or somebody who was happy? So part of being happy is sort of faking it at first until you get to the place where it's habitual, because happiness is one of the gifts we bring to other people. And that little half smile when you sit down, even if you're not feeling so good, it will actually affect the way you feel. It will soften your face, 200 and something muscles in the face. And we practice it. And so we practice happiness. It's not a secret. It's another one of the practices. And cheerfulness is a gift that we give each other. Does that help?
Yeah, very.
Okay.
Very interesting thoughts to think about.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And you don't have to think about it. Actually, you can just remember, wow, I have a body. I'm here with these people. I have enough to eat. I'm really lucky and happy. How can I share this? How can I help other people? I'm happy to be able to do that. Some people, we were talking yesterday about hungry ghosts, you know, pretas, people whose throats are the size of needles and whose mouths are the size of suitcases and everything they touch turns to pus. People in those realms, in the hell realms, are suffering so much they can't help anyone else. So we're in this human realm. This is the only realm from which we can become enlightened. That in itself should be a kind of underpinning of joy. Even if we're not giggling all the time, even if we get knocked off our game, we should come back to that like we come back to counting our breath. That's what I think.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, could you say something, you know, you were talking about how, you know, in our meditation practice, we, you know, sit with the totality of our nature without preferring one side or the other, without preferring enlightenment to delusion or vice versa, and just letting them be. But then there's the other side, which you also talked about, of the precepts, the sort of activism I mean, if you will, maybe sort of an activism of the self, I mean, in the sense of, just as you were saying, you can accept these horrible things around the world, and when you get up, if you have the opportunity, then you can go and actively try and do something about them, be grateful if you can do something about them. What is the balance? I trip myself up on this, and this is why I'm asking the question of, you know, we sit not to improve ourselves, but then we also have this stuff, and we have these tools, we have the precepts, we have the paramitas, and we can actually bring those to bear on our small self in a certain kind of way. But that becomes a kind of doctoring and becomes always from the start infected with a kind of ideal that, as you correctly points out, becomes this huge problem. So can you talk about working with that dichotomy? Is that all clear?
Yeah, it's really clear. It's a real, real conundrum. And again, I need to point out that a lot of it has to do with language. When you say, we work on it, subject, verb, object. Language makes us think that these are solid entities. So when we sit zazen, we're not living a normal human life. We are immersing ourselves in big mind. We're not working on ourselves, really. When you work on yourselves, the best way to work on yourself is to be in a sangha. Other people will polish you. Other people will bring your shortcomings to your attention, believe me. And that's why you can't do it alone. The Buddha was very clear. And in one of the sutras, somebody came up and sat down next to the Buddha. You know, he wanted to hang out with the big bee. Buddha said, no, you want to hang out over there. And he pointed to the sangha. So the whole idea of sitting and working on myself is a grammatical construct that sounds a lot more real and a lot more solid than the fluidity of moment-to-moment changing. So what I think happens, or the way I think about it is, we sit and we let everything soften and kind of dissolve, and then something happens. We see the insubstantiality of our greed or whatever it is we're working on or the thing we're taking too seriously. And then we get up and that thing is a little weakened. And it makes a kind of, feeling. And then you're in the sangha and somebody says, Yozen. And you go, right? And so I think it happens from trying to live the life of a Buddha. Among Buddhas, people who are trying to believe. The big problem is we don't believe we're Buddhas. Buddha told us that we're Buddhas, but we don't believe it. And so we're all practicing and, you know, building a kind of faith and a kind of belief in it. But I think when we start to work too hard, it makes the self too real. It alienates you immediately. It gives great energy to this idea of a separate, deluded self. I like to think that if you made a series of dots on paper in a big circle, form, feeling, impulse, sensation, consciousness, eye, ears, nose, there's an implied center, but it's nothing you can really grab. And consciousness plays this trick on us. It says, I'm the center. I've got it. But, you know, we can't find where the self is. We can't find a color, a shape, a location, a place. As I said yesterday, you know, if a guy tried to sell you a car and he couldn't describe it, tell you the color or the model or where it was parked, you would not take out your wallet.
But what if you don't want to fix the self, say? What if you are on your mats and cushion, and then you go out into the world and you find yourself like sort of recreating some kind of neurotic, harmful behavior that you really don't want to be? I mean, I understand the point of it, how things loosen and soften, but sometimes there are things, I mean, that, or I'll put it in question form, are there times, are there appropriate ways to sort of say, you know, no, this has got to, I can't wait for it to completely soften and dissolve. This needs to be attended to now.
Yeah.
And how to do that without, you know, reifying a self and all those
things. I see. Well, okay. I mean, I was a heroin addict for 12 years and did a lot of damage. As I told somebody, when you catch yourself leaving a child's room with a piggy bank tucked under your arm, you know you've sunk pretty low and something has to be done. But really, what's to do? You try to stop. You know, you try. And there's a great teaching story about a guy who's walking down a street one night and it's very, very dark and he falls into a deep hole. And he goes, oh my God, there were no barriers, there were no lights, this is so incredibly irresponsible, they dug this hole. Damn these people. And he climbs out and he goes home, and the next night he's walking down the street and he falls in again. He says, they still haven't done anything about this. These jerks, I mean, I paid taxes for this, this is infuriating. The third night he's walking down the street and he falls in and he goes, what's the matter with me? I've fallen into the hole. I mean, holy Jesus, help me. And the fourth night he takes a different street. And that's the way we learn everything. I mean, we do it, if wishes were dreams, pigs would fly, you know, and we're all working on things like that. You know, luckily I don't have, let's say, almost impossible impulses to murder people or have sex with small children or stuff. I really have great compassion for people who do. My problems are smaller problems next to that, but I still had to change. So I went into psychotherapy. I started to live in a Buddhist center. I started somewhere and I kept falling and I kept falling. But you sort of fix your intention and you just keep going, and one day you go down a different street. And I don't know how it happens, honestly. I know it's a byproduct of your intention. And your intention, I see. I worked with you yesterday, and I see you as a priest. I don't expect you to be any more perfect than I am. But I know when you really... I know that feeling conscious of what it is that you're trying to solve exacerbates the problem in the short term. But it's actually the beginning of change. That thing that's vexing you and saying, wow, I really have to change this now. That is the beginning of change. And I know that your commitment to the paramitas and a Buddhist life will change it. I don't know when. I don't know when I'm going to levitate in front of you all because I'm so lightened of human karma. But yeah. Anyway, I hope that's helpful. That's as much as I know about it. Yeah.
Time for one last comment or question or response. Michael.
I don't really have a specific question, but just something that I think about a lot, especially when I come here, is that when you're talking about the big mind and how connected we are with the entire universe, and it's just the having that next to then taking control, and actually for me or any one of us here, exercising influence on the universe and taking decisions and having self-will, and at the same time as being just part of the entire universe. It seems like almost like what has happened and what is happening and what will happen in the future is completely out of our control. It's just part of the universe. But then we also have to be responsible people, and we have to make decisions, and we have to look at ourselves and the world and decide what I need to decide what I want, what I believe to be true and good, and then I need to make decisions about my actions in order to try and affect the future. Mm-hmm. But in some small ways we do. I mean, you can, if I go out the door and decide to go left or right, then I'll go left or right. But how much of an influence will that have on the universe further down the line? Just it's not really a question. It's just how do we
I understand.
Sort of balance that in our mind? Like, do you have any control over the universe? And is it worth caring about? And,
I understand exactly. It's a really profound question. So three things I want to say quickly. One is, remember the story about the boy hitting the gong. There's only one thing in the universe that we can control. Only one. And that's our intention. And it's very difficult to control because we all have these monkey minds or gerbil minds. So this practice is the tool, among other things, that helps us fix our intention. So when I became an actor, I didn't begin my career as an actor until I was 39, really. Got my union card, already had a family, I had to figure out a way to make a living. And I'd already started to sit. And I had a lot of trouble because I'd been an anarchist for many years. I didn't use money, I did everything anonymously. And now I was diving into this world of fame and, you know, publicity and stuff I didn't really approve of. But I thought it through and I thought, well, I'm not exploiting anybody. I'm being exploited. And I thought, if I take interdependence seriously, every given situation is a mixture of dark and light possibilities. And so if I go into one and I consistently choose the most enlightened possibilities in that situation, I'm doing my best. We're never going to remake the world. Can't pour a quart in a pint pitcher. But if your intention is fixed on being compassionate, and it just stays in your mind, like on the back burner, just simmering, then it means that every time you make a decision, you're going to remember it. And you're going to say, okay, what's the most compassionate or the most helpful choice that I can make? So, you know, they've done a lot of empirically verifiable scientific tests that have found that when you do an act of kindness for someone, it plays forward three or four times. That person does something beneficial and it plays forward. So we will never see the effect on the universe. But science tells us, and our own experience tells us, that when we're loving and kind to people, it affects them and they respond differently. So the other thing that I wanted to say is, you're a jazz musician. So you know perfectly the two halves of practicing scales and theory and form until you're cross-eyed, and then letting it all go and making decisions faster than humans can think. You know, every time a jazz musician goes through a song, they're following a pattern of chords. And each chord has certain notes you can play and leaves other notes out. And if you hit the wrong notes, it's not going to sound right. And these guys are playing at bebop warp speed, and they've abandoned themselves to big mind after you've done all this practice and drills and scales and ninths and thirteenths and flats and sharps. That's what you're doing on your cushion. Mm-hmm. You're setting your intention. You're drilling yourself. You're practicing restraint. You're practicing compassion. You're practicing generosity, so that when you're out there and it's time to blow, you don't have to think about it. If you ask me, the only way that I can affect the entire universe is through my little life. But this change that we make in ourselves, we don't go back from. I was a communist, I'm not. I was a socialist, I'm still a socialist. I was in politics, and I was really successful until the governor lost the election, the governor I worked for, and then I was out of power, and everything I'd done for the last 8 years was reversed. Those things happen. But you can't take away my intention. And you can't take away my practice of trying to be helpful and trying to be useful. And you are multiplied in this room by this many times. And then I met somebody from another Sangha yesterday. He's practicing the same thing. We just picked up like long lost friends. So I have to believe that as this practice grows and more people are interested in it, I have to believe it has an effect, but it may be a 1,000-year effect. And we have to give up the greediness of wanting to be proved correct in this lifetime and seeing the results in this lifetime. I'd like it. I'm greedy that way. I want to see it. But if I have to, I'm going to trust Buddha and the 95 generations and the living models that I got to see in my life and keep going because it's a lovely way to live. I can't think of a better one. So why not? And if you don't care, why would you do anything? Right? So might as well care. I'd rather be disappointed than not be engaged in the only world I have as a human. You know? And so I actually think that artists, especially jazz artists, I'm biased, are exemplars of a kind of way to be. They have a perfect balance of incredibly difficult, complex form and incredibly liberated freedom that they're doing at a speed where no human can think, really. I hope that helps.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's the loveliest way to be, most beautiful way to be. We may as well.
Yeah.